understanding of the Mideast crisis or the Mideast situation. Note particularly the word toward. I don't guarantee that I can tell you what the solution is, but I think all of us ought to be very much concerned with it and do as much as we can to understand it, because we probably have more possibility of a worldwide conflagration breaking out in the Mideast. Now, I speak out of a background of 7 trips to the land of Palestine. The first one in 1936, when I was there for a sort of a 2-month study. And the subsequent visits have been on behalf of either the Commission on Younger Churches and Orphan Missions, or as chairman of the Commission on World Missions of the National Lutheran Council. And that involved administration of the work of the LWF on behalf of the Arab refugees, and a series of discussions with the government of Israel in order to settle the property problem. There have been 5 different German mission societies that work for many years in Palestine. These 5 sort of put their hands together and call themselves Palestina Werk. And they, all of their work was concerned about getting some kind of settlement of the property issue. Israel had taken over their properties. And some were returned, some were not. However, after a considerable discussions with the government of Israel, a satisfactory settlement whereby they reimbursed these mission societies. Well, during this time I had many, many discussions, of course, with the government man, a man by the name of Mr. Haim Kadmon, who was the Administrator General of Justice for the Government of Israel. And I got to see a number of things from the point of view of the Jews. Perhaps in getting a background, we should allow ourselves to go back for a while. Let's remind ourselves that this land which we speak of as Palestine was a part of Turkey, of the Turkish Empire, up until World War, after World War I. You will recall that Turkey was an ally of Germany. She lost the war along with Germany, and she lost that whole area that she had ruled over. When the time came for the League of Nations to hold its first session, the League of Nations gave its attention to all the colonial areas and to areas that had belonged to one power or the other, and as a result of the war, lost control of that. And I think we should remind ourselves also that President Woodrow Wilson was the man who gave birth to the dream of a League of Nations. He stood a lot of criticism, and many of the people criticized him as an idealist, but he persevered until the League of Nations became a reality, and then his own nation refused to enter the League of Nations. While I was teaching high school, I wrote an oration for one of the boys in a class of public speech that I was teaching, and I called it The Betrayal. And it was a plea, as it were, to recognize the foul play. We hadn't understood what Woodrow Wilson was about. But anyway, the League of Nations became a reality, evidence that most of the nations of the world recognized that this was an excellent idea. And then they set up an arrangement whereby colonial areas that had been released as a result of the war were declared mandate areas, and they were assigned to given nations who would be responsible to be, as it were, foster parents for this area. Now, the area that we know historically as Syria, that was assigned to France, and France received the responsibility of bringing this ward along until it could hand everything over to Syria, and Syria would be independent. The area south of Syria, as far as the Suez Canal, and then way over to the east, was assigned to Great Britain as a mandate area. Britain divided this up into four parts. She was aware that there were Arab princes that had a good lineage and were well respected among the Arabs. And so she formulated one mandate that since or after a while became Iraq and ruled over by an Arab prince. She formulated another, which we know today as Saudi Arabia, and Prince Ibn Saud became the king of that area. She formulated another, which was called Transjordania, and set a prince over that, who was of the Hashemite royal household. And then what we know as Palestine proper, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, and then from the Gulf, or not the Gulf, but from the Suez Canal north to Syria. That was Palestine. Britain did not assign that to anyone, but she took responsibility for that and did it directly and had appointed what she called a royal commissioner. I think it's important for us to recognize, when so oftentimes we say, oh, they do a bad job of this or that, that here you had several mandates that were administered and brought along until each of the areas, except for Palestine, became independent and have acted ever since as independent nations, and have done so with credit. Now, it's probably as desirable that, having looked at the land a little bit, we also look at the people. We perhaps think of Jews as being the people who have inhabited this area. And once upon a time, long years ago, they did. But after the year 70, when Titus destroyed the temple and defeated the last remnant of a Jewish army down on the southwest shores of the Dead Sea. Since that day, there have been precious few Jews in the land of Palestine. Many of them spread out into colonies or little settlements, because the Jews were great merchants then, as they are today, and there had been settlements along the Mediterranean, so that people fleeing would probably have a contact point among their own people. So it was easier, in a sense, for them to leave the land when the Romans took over with a strong arm. Well, of course, the Arabs were living in that area, and they continued to live there. And as the Jews left, the Arabs moved into that area. Much of the land of Palestine during this long period, for about 2,000 years, has been in the hands of rich Arab landowners. And they would engage Bedouins or people who had been working on the soil to farm the land for them. But there's one difference between a renter of land there and what we may think of. In this country, if someone rents land, they probably are on the land for a few years, or they might be a lifetime, but they might be there only a few years and then move on to some other place. But most of these Arabs living on sizable land portions owned by rich Arab landowners stayed there from generation to generation. And even though they did not own the land, for them that was home. And the roots sank into the soil. You look back at the place where you grew up as a child, perhaps a youth, you have a different feeling towards that area than you do many other parts of the country. But if you had all of your relatives staying put where you grew up, and year after year, that would really be home for you, wouldn't it? And think of the emotions that are attached to that soil. Now, the Jews seemingly forgot all about their land until about 75 years ago. Then a Jewish rabbi, Herzl, in Vienna, got together other Jews and raised the question whether it was not time to think in terms of returning to their homeland. And he got people interested, and they formulated what they called the Zionist organization. And this Zionist organization had the one purpose of getting people to return to the land of their fathers. That was one place where they dreamed of the possibility of having peace and not floating and drifting from one part of the world to another. They succeeded, or the Zionist movement succeeded, in getting a number of Russian Jews to go back to Palestine. They were about the only ones to begin with. And for that reason, even to this day, the people who are in leadership positions in Israel are pretty heavily Russian Jews. For in a sense, the Russian Jews were the equivalent of our Pilgrim Fathers, and they being on the land first, naturally, to them came the responsibility to carry out leadership tasks. Let me use several illustrations to, first of all, to nail down this thought of how the Arabs felt about this land, that their roots were deeply anchored here.
Excuse me, yes. Ask you a question?
Yes.
What?
Interrupt at any point.
What is the historical, at what point in history did the Jews, were they dispersed when the fall of Jerusalem, or way back, or how?
At the fall of Jerusalem, well, all along there had been Jews moving into areas where there was an opportunity to do business. And that's why you have Paul writing to congregations at Corinth, because among those Jews there were Christian Jews through the evangelism that had been conducted by Paul and by others. And so he writes to Philippi and to Ephesus. And
the Jews were kind of leaving all the area.
Yes, but these were not large numbers, such as, that is, the land did not become practically denuded of its Jewish population as it did shortly after, well, with the year 70 and shortly after. Then they just made an exodus out of the land.
Well, they did.
Yes. Yeah. That was a military defeat. The Jews were tenacious, and they didn't give up. when Titus destroyed Jerusalem. And Titus, by the way, was dispatched because there had been little rebellions against the Roman government, one after another, and the Roman emperor became tired of all these pinpricks, and so he dispatched Titus, and Titus destroyed Jerusalem, and then went after the last remnant of the Hebrew army. And they made a great stand down at, the southwest part of the Dead Sea. When it comes now to the Arabs and their love for the land, I think maybe we'll take the Jews first on this. Even though the Jews had been gone for many, many years, they still had a deep feeling, an emotional feeling for the land of their fathers. I recall one day when I was talking with a Jewish merchant over on the Hebrew side, and I mentioned that I had to go over to the other side, that was the Arab side at that time, and conduct some work on behalf of the Arab refugees. We were supposed to get the budget ready for the next year. And just at the mention that I was going over on the other side, he suddenly got a glazed look in his face and stared out into space. Then after a while he said, "Oh, for a chance to stand on Mount Zion." And you could see that this really had gripped the depth of his soul. I think of in 1936 when I was there. That happened to be, that is included in this 8-week period, was Holy Week. And I decided, if at all possible, I would like to get an invitation to some Jewish home when they were celebrating the Passover, or the Seder, as they call it. And I conferred with a rabbi, and he said, that would be very, very difficult unless you knew them very well, for this is a very personal and family affair. But, he said, I think I can arrange for you to be invited to the Seder festival at a pension, a sort of a boarding house, where he knew the rabbi who would preside as the father of the household. Well, I had always thought of the Passover and the celebration of it as a kind of a very sober thing. And my attitude with regard to that was completely transformed by what I experienced. This was a feast comparable to what an American home will arrange for Thanksgiving festival. And there was an accent of joy and celebration. But after we had eaten, then there were children that were sitting at other tables, and they were brought next to the main table where the elders sat. And the rabbi proceeded to catechize them about the going out of Egypt. Well, I studied the eyes and the faces of those children very much. And those faces told me an awful lot. They were not holding back and embarrassed about that they might fail, but they were eager to answer his question. They were ready the moment he had put a question. So he would have to direct whom he wanted to answer. And as I saw the glint in those eyes and the sparkle there and the joy in their faces, then I realized that the land of the fathers and its history and their being a part of it now had taken hold of these children. Well, when you run into experiences of this kind, you know that these people have roots there. I'll wait a little bit before we go to the Arabs' feeling for this. When the Zionist movement sent settlers back to Palestine, they found the mountains of Judea practically denuded. The Turkish authorities had taxed heavily, and included in that was taxing trees. Well, it was easy then to cut taxes by cutting down trees. But in the process of cutting down trees, there had been a lot of soil erosion. But these Jews, and I was made aware that some of them were PhDs, when they came back to the land of their fathers, went up into the Lake Hule district north of the Lake of Galilee, where there's a lot of swamp-like soil and much of black soil. And this was brought to the areas that need to be clothed. And in many instances, they did it with their hands, coming there and getting to work at once. These Russian Jews had a philosopher by the name of Gordon who had worked among them. And he placed a very heavy emphasis on the dignity of work and the necessity to be concerned about working, and that this was an honorable thing to do. So they started with great dispatch the moment that they arrived there. If you were to visit in Israel today, and you would get off your airliner down near Tel Aviv, and you were to ride on up to Jerusalem, you would find that the mountainsides on both sides of the road now are clothed with beautiful pine trees that have acquired a good deal of size. And many American Jews contributed to this by giving a tree or so many trees, and they were planted there. They went at it with great vigor at once. Now, other Jews began to filter into the land, but for all practical purposes, one could say there were no Jews prior to the activity of the Zionists. Maybe 2,000 or something like that over the whole area. But with the, yes.
Another question. How did the Zionists, did they just move in? Did they have visas, or did they have permission, or were they given land, or?
I'm glad you raised that question. The Zionists, in returning, bought land from Arab landowners. And once they had bought the land, then the peasants who had lived on the land were preempted, and there you have the beginning of the Arab refugee problem. And of course, also there you have the beginning of their feelings about this. From another point of view, one can say that here's a nation, at least at this stage of the game, did not go in with sword and warfare, but bought their way in. There probably wouldn't have been a heavy return, because not more than, there were less than 1 million people living in Palestine at this time, and about 1920, shortly after they began, or after World War I had been settled, and the Zionists had been at work for some 30 to 40 years, there were not more than about 11% of the population consisted of Jews. Some years later, about 16%. But then you had this phenomenon of the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. Apart from the pogroms of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis against the Jewish people, there probably wouldn't be a nation of Israel today. There would not have been enough going back. But under the persecution of Jews in Germany, then many German Jews returned. And so you have the beginning of the formation of the what later became the nation of Israel. Now, as Britain watched what was taking place and saw the unrest among the Arabs, then she said, there can't be more than so many percent or so many numbers coming back. And when she set a level on this, then the Jews began to come in under cover of darkness. They would come in boats that would anchor off the shore of the Mediterranean. And then they would come into the land with small boats during the night and would take over. And with the Zionist organization having raised money for them, and they'd buy more land, and those who owned the land, as there was competition for buying it, they got good prices, so their concern was only at that point. In visiting, I talked to several Jews about how they felt about being a part of the land of Israel. One banker in Jerusalem with whom I visited, I said, how do you feel? Your window looks out upon the wall between the Arab part and the Israeli part. And at that time, there was a good deal of shooting across the wall. And quite a few people were killed. Oh, he says, it's great. It's great. For here, he says, I am a free person. I said, what do you mean free? Are you fully free when you've got this danger on them, the Arabs might attack most any time? And then he said something which, unless he had said it directly, I wouldn't have imagined it. Oh, he said, I used to be a banker in Berlin. And he said, if I walked down the street, I had a feeling that somebody was saying, ah, there goes a Jew. And that people were always setting me apart from the others in the land, and were pointing, not actually pointing, but he felt that way. And here he said, I am just one of our people. Well, I discovered that there were other Jews that felt that way. Now, with the land becoming crowded, the Arabs raised one protest after another. The first one began in 21. Then there was one in 23. And then there was one, I think, in 27. And there was another one in 29. And there was another one in 33. And there was another one when we were there in 1936. And during this period of time, there were Jews killed by the Arabs. They had a mass funeral while we were about the time of Holy Week, while we were over there. The Arabs were filled with hatred, and they were saying that these Jews would have to be run into the Mediterranean. And they spoke quite openly about this. I found that even the Christian Arabs, when I talked with them, those who were leaders, they objected to the LWF working with freeing some of the property, because this was an implicit recognition that Israel might be there as a state and a recognized country. And I just had to say, no, I can't accept your reasoning. And we had to go on with that. Britain finally felt this was such a thankless job that she notified the United Nations that she was ready to give it up. Then the United Nations appointed an international commission to study it. And they did that, and you had representatives from Asia, from Africa, from Australia, from Europe, from the United States. So it was a large commission, and they made a thorough study of it. And they recommended that a part of Palestine should be set aside as an independent area for the Jews. So that should be Israel. But the western part of Jerusalem and the land down to the Jordan should remain Arab country, and that might be united with the Kingdom of Jordan. When this was recommended, it seemed as though this was the time to strike. And so the Israeli leaders made a declaration of independence May 14th, 1948. That became their July 4th. And when they made this declaration, it was acknowledged by the United Nations. But then the Arabs saw that if they didn't strike, then they would probably be in difficulty. And so they attacked. Here I'm going to tell you what was told me by Mr. Cadman. One day when we got, at a sticky point, and he wouldn't yield and I wouldn't yield about these properties for the German missions, then when we hit a place like that, we would probably go out and have a cup of coffee or tea or something. And we went over to the King David Hotel and sat out on a sort of a patio back of the King David Hotel where you looked out over Judea down to the Jordan. And as we were sitting there sipping tea, he became very communicative about the trouble when the Declaration of Independence had been made. He said the Arabs attacked and we had nothing more than Molotov cocktails, he said, with which to fight. He said, we had one anti-tank gun, and the Arabs had the Arab Legion, which had been trained by the British Army. And word came to us, he said, that the Arab Legion was coming down from the north toward the Damascus Gate. And he said, we had only one man who knew how to handle this anti-tank gun. And he was in the hospital, had a bad arm, so he couldn't handle the gun. So we hurried up to the hospital and told this man that he had to train someone to handle that anti-tank gun. And he said, I can't train anyone in just a matter of few minutes. But he said, I'll go get up and go and do the best that I can. So he went, he had one arm in a sling, and he stationed himself at a vantage point at the Damascus Gate. And he waited until, I don't remember now whether it was a tank or an armored carrier, they had both types and it's at intervals. And he aimed very carefully, and he demolished the first tank, or knocked it out of commission, and then another one, and exploded. Now the Arabs didn't know how many they had behind the Damascus Gate and how much, and they turned tail and fled to the north. Now if they had come ahead and risked losing a little bit more, they would have just taken everything over. Well, with this happening, the UN stepped in and tried to declare a truce, and there was a truce of a few days. And he said, during this time when there was no fighting, a rest period as it were, they hoped that the UN hoped that they could get an armistice declared. Then the Jews went to work on a pile of old jeeps that had been left there by the British from the time of the war. and they would take the good parts and put them together until they had 25 to 30 jeeps, something like that. And they filled this with soldiers, with rifles, and they fled down, or they drove down behind Nasser's Egyptian army and began to shoot. And Nasser's army didn't know how many there were, they weren't informed, and they turned tail and retreated to Egypt. Now, when the facts later became known, this forever, as long as Nasser lived, remained as a sort of an escutcheon of shame, feeling he, a military man, had fled so easily. Then there was a stepping in on the part of the UN, and there was a Swedish man by the name of Count Folke Bernadotte that was sent in as a mediator. But the Count Folke Bernadotte had not been at work long before he was assassinated. And a year or so earlier, before Israel had declared its independence, because the grandfather of the present king of Jordan, King Abdullah, was disposed to try to settle things peacefully, and he was down in the mosque in Jerusalem praying, and while he was there, because it was known that he was peacefully disposed toward the Jews, he was assassinated. Now, you had two in a row. Then Ralph Bunche, let's remember he was a Negro, a mulatto. He was the assistant to Count Folke Bernadotte. And Ralph Bunche then was appointed by the United Nations as the chief mediator. And he entered into discussions and was after they were over, and he had developed a document that both Jews and Arabs accepted. He received high praise from United Nations authorities on what he had accomplished. Then you have, this is about the year 49. It was in 48 that he declared their independence, and then 1950, I think, that Ralph Bunche in February negotiated this agreement. About this time, then King, or President Nasser of Egypt, seized the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal had been owned by an international corporation, and the agreement that they entered into with Egypt, this was to go on for, I think, till 1988 it expires. But Nasser seized it, contrary to the agreement that had been made, which had been approved internationally. He seized the Suez, and with the seizure of the Suez Canal, he said there would be no Israeli freight allowed to transit that canal. Now, this was just about choking Israel in terms of carrying on any trading and export to the east. Well, what did the Jews do then? If your imagination is good, you know the Red Sea moves up at a sort of a northwest angle toward the Mediterranean. The arm that goes up in the most direct manner extends toward where the Suez Canal begins, and then the Suez Canal would carry traffic through to the Mediterranean. But just where this arm of the Red Sea moves up towards where the canal is, there is another arm that moves off in the other direction called the Gulf of Aqaba. And up at the upper end of the Gulf of Aqaba is the port of Eilat. When Solomon was king, he mined copper in that area, And Elath was a very important harbor city. And Israeli took this over. Well, Nasser makes objections. This is taken to the UN. And the UN assigned a United Nations force to guard in the Sinai. And the Jews got along very well with this protection of the United Nations force, and things seemed to be going well for them, too well from the point of view of Nasser. Then Nasser says, he made a public demand of the United Nations that it withdraw its guards that had been stationed in various areas of the Sinai desert. And lo and behold, the man who then was, what was the name of the man from Southeast Asia who was the general secretary for a while? Well, he buckled under the demands of Nasser, and he certainly should have put that to the at least the Security Council.
That was Utant.
That's right, Utant. Great man in many ways, but he certainly didn't have any stamina at that point, and he buckled under Nasser at once. And when he did that, then Israel felt they had better attack then, and they attacked. Meanwhile, since their independence in 48, this was in the 67-year war, or what was called the Six-Day War, and they swept through, and had it not been probably for the UN stepping in again, that's when they got all the area from, they took eastern Jerusalem, and they took the area down to the Jordan, and went up and took the Golan Heights that looked down upon Syria, and the entire Sinai. And that was territory about five times as much as the territory that they had occupied up until that time.
Excuse me. Was not a lot of Matthew's reaction, a reaction more or less against European influence in the Middle East, and what it was against so much, you know, Israel being there per se. Having been under European powers for so long, there would be a large deal of resentment and probably a large deal of fear at a European power being planted in the middle of the Middle East.
Well, you couldn't regard Israel exactly as a European power. There are many of
them. Yeah, I realize that, yes. You know, practically speaking, but I'm wondering if it couldn't have been perceived this way. Or at least to some of the hostility which was experienced towards
it may have been compounded by that somewhat, but I don't think there's any question but what the chief motivation was: their ill will for the Jews, and to wit, the assassination of Abdullah, the assassination of Count Volker Bernadotte, there were others that were assassinated also. And whenever there was anyone who spoke at all favorably toward the Jews, this was resented. And they continued to talk about the necessity of driving the Jews into the Mediterranean, that they must not be an independent nation, up until just a few years ago. What was it, a year ago last spring, when the present leader of Sadat of Egypt, when he was down at Citadel, North Carolina, and then he announced publicly that they would recognize Israel as an independent nation. That was the first time that any Arab had said that.
I'm aware of that, and I'm not disputing the fact that there is obvious racism. I guess I'm just trying to touch at what the roots of that racism might be from an Arab perspective.
I think the root was largely in there having been preempted by someone who was stronger economically, and they felt they'd been taken advantage of. In other words, they'd been chased out of their home.
Okay.
And the Jews are recognized in all parts of the world as skillful businessmen. Mm-hmm. And so the Arab world was fearful of that and knew that they had many of contacts in Europe. Well, you will recall that about this time, Israel got France to join her and Britain to join her in taking the Suez Canal back. And they took it out of the hands of Nasser. The UN demanded of these three nations, Israel, Britain, and France, that they withdraw. And President Eisenhower joined in the support of the UN. If President Eisenhower had not done that, then I think Britain and France would have just stayed, and they would have made an arrangement whereby it could be used internationally and the Israelis could use it as well as others. And there was considerable resentment in France for a while that Eisenhower took that stand, but at that time the word of the U.S. was more powerful than what it is today. And they withdrew, and so Nasser again took over the canal. Well, the Arabs, having been thoroughly beaten in 67, were planning about attacking once again. This time they thought that they would do it stealthily and that they would do it at a time when the Jews were busy with one of their great festivals. And they chose the time of the Yom Kippur festival and attacked. And it was a lightning attack. And they rolled over Israel. And very likely Israel would have been wiped out then as a nation, except for the UN. Israel appealed to the United States for help. And we actually sent them out of the stock of our own army, we sent them some of our latest planes and other equipment, and with that, their army rallied and were able to drive the Arabs back. But had we not done that at that time, the Arabs would have been the victors. And of course, that too has accented the Arabs' antipathy towards the U.S. Well, we've got to move a little closer to our own time. This was in 1973. The United Nations established an armistice, and they asked that there be a peace conference, and representatives from Israel and from Israel should meet, and meet with UN people. But if Israel accepted, then the Arabs didn't accept, and they were sort of teeter-tottering back and forth on this. And the U.S. was very, very cautious about maybe the Russians being involved in a U.N.-sponsored peace treaty. And so it didn't get to be called. And we have remained since that time where they have been like two fierce dogs at one another's throats. Sadat really took a great step when he went to Jerusalem about a year ago now. He had to risk being assassinated because there were plenty of Arab extremists that were ready to do with him as they had done with King Abdullah, but he showed great courage. And Nasser has no doubt been behind the scene encouraging President Carter to do what he has done now. And I think there is evidence that the Jews have encourage some of this also. And now they are meeting there at Camp David to work out, hopefully, the equivalent of a peace treaty, but at least some direction so that they would know which way they're walking in the future. Now, with this request of the United Nations that they talk with them, with a special committee which they established, they also said that Israel should withdraw from the Golan Heights, she should withdraw from the West Bank, she should withdraw from the Gaza Strip. And of course, Israel has continually said no to this. But now and then you get some leakage of, they're willing to discuss maybe giving up, but then there come some strong statements that they couldn't give up more than a very small part, and this will have to be discussed and talked. I've got some bulletins put out by the Egypt and some by the Israeli government, and each one is constantly blaming the other and fortifying themselves with their accusations of the way in which the other one proceeds. So this is really a very involved thing and bound together by strong feelings, terrific emotional outbreak. And there's the serious fear that Israel today has the bomb, so that if war should break out again and they got into a tight situation, they might actually use that. And so it seems as though peace isn't a luxury, it's a need. It's an absolute need. And if it doesn't come to that part of the world, then peace may be vacated in other parts of the world. You know, in the eastern part of Jerusalem, when the Jews in the Six-Day War took the eastern part of Jerusalem, they were violating a decision or a resolution of the United Nations, but they paid no attention to that. The United Nations had voted shortly after the Six-Day War that Jerusalem should be an international city, and with it it would include areas maybe down to include Bethlehem and then some other small portions, and would be a city that would be respected by all religions. The Mohammedans have an interest there, the Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, the Protestants, all religions have. This would have been a great idea. Because I was about ready to go over to have some more discussions with the government of Israel about the property, I thought that when I saw in the New York Times that this issue of the internationalization of Jerusalem was going to be discussed and a resolution had been introduced, I went over, thought that was a part of my business really to see what their reaction was and what kind of discussions would be there on the floor of the Security Council. And I heard something that I would never have thought I could have heard on the floor of the United Nations. In the course of the discussion, Charles Malik of Lebanon, foreign minister and also their representative to the United Nations, spoke. He got up and he said, gentlemen, in this body there are always presuppositions that we must take into account when we discuss any issue. Usually it's the political presuppositions. In this matter, there are political presuppositions. But in this matter, there are also religious presuppositions. And I submit, he says, that they are of the prior importance. And then he said, for this is the country where our Lord walked while he was here on earth, where he taught mankind, and where he healed the sick, and where he went to Calvary's cross for the sins of the world, and then his right hand shot up, and where on the third day he rose from the dead. Now this said right there in the Security Council. And across from Charles, or right alongside of Charles Malik, was Ebba Eben, the representative of the government of Israel. And he conducted himself as a gentleman. But right across there sat Gromyko, who then was the foreign minister for Russia, and a couple of his assistants. And they were kind of small talk. Now, when somebody is talking, you try to give them your attention, but they were kind of talking and smiling, not loud, but at least they...
Distracting,
and then again it appeared as though he's speaking with this forthright Christian conviction that they were sort of poo-pooing this man of faith. We have frequently some fine Christian people who represent us at some of these international levels. And I have seen several times when the work of Fred Nolde, who was there as the representative for the World Council of Churches and on behalf of all churches, was able to put in a word at the right time that was of great importance in settlements. And if you ever went with Fred Nolde through the corridors of the United Nations, he knew most of the people that he met by their first name. He had such a close relationship, and they respected him in turn, whether they were Christians or not. I don't know how long this conference is going to take or continue at Camp David. I suspect that the best they can do is to get something where they feel that there is a basis for taking, or a direction in which they can move. And then probably adjourn and have another meeting, because you can't hurry through something of this kind. There has been a good deal of debate about what the attitude of the United States should be. Should the United States offer a plan? I would suspect that if Jimmy Carter is a skilled man, he will ask enough questions, so instead of offering a plan formally by the kind of questions he'll ask, he will sort of outline the substance of what might be a plan that would be their plan, but something that would be viable.
Aren't the Arabs a little bit apprehensive of the great number of financial backers in the Jewish United States, and the Jews in the United States who are backing Israel, that they're rather concerned about what the United States
there's
does
no
say
quest-
because of that reason?
There's no question about that. And that there are many of the Jews in this country that keep prodding the government. And there it takes some strong convictions for our government to stand up against that.
How do you feel about the United States selling planes to both Egypt and Israel and Arab countries, knowing they are all the ill feeling that exists among all three nations?
Sometimes it's not just how one feels about it. That is, if we didn't do it, Russia would do it forthright, and they wouldn't sell them. She'd probably give it to them. And we know, of course, that Sadat told Russia to get out. At one point, Nasser did before Sadat came in. And so it becomes a medium through which the United States maintains the confidence of both sides. And so much depends upon that confidence being there. Now, what should the church do? There are some churches that say, well,
we should be on the side of Israel and everything, who maintain that prophecy makes it rather clear that Israel was once again to be reestablished as a nation. Well, when you read the 37th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, you can make a pretty good case for that. But I have said constantly, it does not seem to me that it is a question of us trying to guess how God is going to carry out his purposes. But our focus must be on doing that which is just towards both sides, a matter of righteousness. And I think that thus far the Arab refugees haven't really gotten a fair shake at all. And with the thought of getting them rehabilitated, we could very well, the United Nations and the U.S. perhaps contributing heavily toward that, provide some assistance at that point. I have felt there have been times when Billy Graham has been dangerously close to taking the position that one should support Israel and their demands, because this is what prophecy demands. I can't take that position, but the church must take some position. And of course, perhaps that which is very important, that we keep our people informed and that we help them to see that here is a place where we really ought to be in constant intercession for our leaders. Well, we're 3 minutes past the time for adjournment. If there are any questions and some of you want to stay after to ask them, that's I'll stay.
May I?
Yes.
You were starting to talk about, you know, the Arabs and their claim to the land and their feel for the land. You want to say something more about that?
Yes, and I didn't finish up about the internationalization of Jerusalem. The UN voted that it should be internationalized, but when they did that, then the Arabs acted and they took it over, the Jews took it over, and today the whole city of Jerusalem is in the hands of Israel. And Israel moved its capital up from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But if you go over there and you want to do business with your own ambassador, you can't find him in Jerusalem. You'll have to go down to Tel Aviv. And all the other embassies have continued to remain in Tel Aviv, for they know that their nations voted that Jerusalem should be internationalized. That's a rather anomalous position. But this is another aspect of how complicated the situation is over there. Now, backing up to Karen's question, the Arabs moved in by just purchasing land from the Arab landowners. And when they then had bought enough land so that...
The Jews.
And then we must remember that there were two things which the West did. During the war, there was a promise made by the British government that the Arabs would receive political and economic independence after the war. For the Allies were being hard pressed and they wanted the assistance of the Arabs. And then on the other hand, they also promised something to the Jews, which has become known in history as the Balfour Declaration, which said that when the war was over, there would be an opportunity for the Jews to establish a homeland in Palestine. David Ben-Gurion, at an open hearing in Tel Aviv on one occasion said that the Balfour Declaration was formulated by Zionist leaders. And he went a step farther and said, we spent a great deal of time trying to shape up a phrase which could be interpreted that we were just thinking of a cultural home, and it could also be interpreted that we were thinking in terms of a political, national home. The Zionists have been alert all along. Now, we could say, well, didn't the British government know what it was doing? With one hand it promised things to Arabs, with the other hand it promised things to the Jews. In fact, when the Balfour Declaration was issued, then the Arabs protested to President Roosevelt of our nation and to the British government, and then they said, the British sent a message called, in history, Hogarth's message, saying that they would stay by the Arabs in the promise that they had given them. Well, you know, getting promises, both sides getting promises, it's become a terrific tangle. And we need to pray that the wisdom of several Solomons may be given those who are now there at Camp David. Because this is the first time that you've got the head of each government coming together. Thanks for this afternoon.